good to see a lot of people on the spaces tonight. We have the I&M Bank CEO and acting CFO coming up. We want to deep dive into the FY23 performance results for I&M Bank that were released today. We'll just get started quickly. I want to introduce my co-host a little bit, Rona. Maybe you can say hi.
Thanks, Eric. Hello, everyone. My name is Rona. I think many of you know me on the spaces or from personal interactions. I've been covering Kenyan banks for nearly 20 years now.
Thank you so much. Bihara, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit, brief on who you are, and then you can introduce your CFO, and then we can get started.
Thanks, Eric, and glad to be back here on Mongo Spaces. My name is Kihara Maina. I'm the regional CEO for I&M Group, and today I'm joined by our acting CFO, Billing Atich, who's doing this for the first time at Mongo Spaces.
Kihara, I should remind the audience that you are one of the first listed companies here we hosted back in 2022. So glad to have you back. You've grown ever since, and I&M Group has also grown ever since. So you should appreciate the growth, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having us again here, and congratulations on all the growth that you've made over that period of time.
Thank you so much. Let's start with maybe the broad overview, and then you'll come to the CFO later. As a CEO, you can give us a bit of perspective on the high-level view on I&M Group's FY23 performance.
Yes. So we reported our results today, and our PBT for the year at 16.7 billion for the group. And we also reported that we were going to be giving out a dividend of 2.55 shillings. Earnings per share came out at 7.60 shillings. And we discussed earlier the drivers of that income, mainly customer number growth, and the back of that growth in deposits and loans and advances, both coming in at about 33%, which is a very strong performance given the circumstances under which we were operating.
We'll dig into the numbers. Maybe start with the interest income versus interest expense and how it evolved throughout.
So interest income was on the back of loans and advances growth, which I said came in at just about 33%. And that was in both foreign currency and local currency. At the same time, it was across the board when we look at all of our different markets, both corporate and institutional banking and the personal and business banking segments that we have across the group. This was also widespread growth right across our different markets. We saw loan book growth. And in terms of disaggregating the numbers, so certainly from an interest expense side, we did see the impact of rising interest rates across both the foreign currency and domestic currency books, as well as, of course, on the interest income side, a similar performance driven by the macro changes that we'd seen over the period of 23. That meant that we were able to protect our margins. Difficult at first, of course, because we were responding to the market changes. We tried to protect customers as much as possible. But the reality is, of course, that we also responded to signals from the market and had to make the necessary changes.
Now we go to the CFO a little bit. Maybe you can give us a bit of perspective on how the non-funded income progressed in 2023, especially start with the impact on FX trading income and all.
So in 2023, and just focusing on Nairobi, we saw the FX volume traded grew, and though the margin tapered slightly down when you compare 23 and 22, we had slightly higher margins. So because of that, almost a flat performance year on year. But the other transactional fees picked up. We had a good rise in trade finance. Your transaction fees also ticked upwards. So overall, we saw a 10% growth in non-funded incomes. So primarily, this really, it's a reflection of how our customers are transacting with us. We saw growth through various channels, and that led to these non-funded revenues.
And then just below that, this is the provisions all around and how NPLs evolved, especially in 2023. Either of you can give us a bit of perspective and flavor on how those progress, given the macro environment that we're dealing with, rising interest rates, inflation was high last year also.
So you would have seen that our cost of risk or provisioning has gone up 31% year on year. And this really is an outcome of how our customers are impacted by the various macros. You know the effects went through. You would know also interest rates also went up. And all these inputs, our customers are feeling the impact. Non-performing loans tick upwards year on year. And because of that, we had to be prudent and take in more provisions. Hence, you'll see that 31% increase. But the metric we would really track is the net NPA. So we'll see we closed at 5%, and that we would want to bring it down as we move along to the regions of 2%.
And then just before that, I actually had failed to ask a bit on the trends on net interest income and how that evolved in 23. Maybe you can give us a bit of flavor there. And also, how are you managing interest expenses in a rising rate environment where customers also demand deposits to be paid a little bit higher? So you can talk a little bit about that.
So around net interest income, as Kihara say, in the first half of the year, rates going up, but we took the view that let's not quickly pass the high cost of funds to the customer. So we took the hit. But as the year evolved now towards the end of the year, now I think rates went up. You would see government also sucking out deposits from retail. And the impact of that is our cost of funds went up. So speaking with our customer, they agreed to base rate upward increases. And that now began giving us a cushion in our net interest income. So if you compare 2022 and 2023, interest income actually has gone up, but actually you will see a jump on interest expense. So that is purely reflective for us to keep the deposit market share and also competing with the government for the very same deposit, and we had to pay up a little bit higher. The second part of the question,
interest income and interest expense and how you're managing it in this environment.
So if I can weigh in on that one. Yes, so we are aware it would be best to fund our assets on our balance sheet from CASA. So we've seen CASA ratio actually improving over the last 3 years. Now we are headed towards 40%. So intentionally, yes, we're not shying away from the expensive deposits, but we want to improve that mix of CASA deposits. So the impact of that will be to cushion or to improve our net interest margin. So we think we will see this improving as we move forward now that we are 40% and headed towards the regions of 50s. In terms of the cheap deposits.
And how else are you managing the rest of the expense on the income statement? Are you managing that in this kind of environment that we are in?
Yes, the costs that we carry have to be disaggregated so that you can appreciate what's driving them. Of course, the general inflation increases will affect a number of lines, so particularly our staff lines. And we appreciate that we have to make the necessary investments in our stock portfolio so that we take on. The increases in investments in infrastructure, particularly technology infrastructure, we have largely done the key investments that we needed. We've got a few pockets here and there across the group that we are continuing to do, but we are thankful that most of the technology investments are largely behind us. We are still going to deal with maintenance and feature enrichment in a number of our digital platforms, but that is not as expensive as we have experienced over the past 4 years. I had mentioned during our presentation earlier that we've invested over 4 billion shillings in technology in the past 3 or 4 years or so. So what we expect now is that we're going to be sweating those assets, those technology assets, and we expect that the cost to serve our customers is going to come down as a result. Yes, we are expanding our physical footprint, opening new branches. That is being done carefully. We are choosing locations. We're choosing the kind of format of branches that we are putting in place to really get low cost footprint for servicing customers without compromising quality. And at the same time, of course, in terms of how we are engaging with our clients, the fact that these assets are now in place, driving utilization is going to be key to keeping costs down. So making sure that we sign up more and more customers, and we are now seeing 78% of our customers are digitally active. What we want to drive now is most transactions onto the digital platforms. We are targeting over 85-90% of our transactions happening on technology platforms. Of course, we are also being smart about how we do other things to support revenue growth. So if we look at our marketing initiatives, and we've got a big focus on brand building, we're also making use of digital platforms like this one of yours to say we are able to reach more and more audiences, more and more clients smartly without necessarily having to break the bank to do so. We are very focused on costs. We have been a leader in the cost to income ratio, particularly in the Kenyan market. As we've gone through the investment period, we've seen that tick up, but now we are expecting as we reap these dividends, we're going to get back to the levels we've seen below, initially targeting in this plan period, our Imara 3.0 cycle to get below 45%.
Now it's time to look at the bottom line and also in terms of ROE. How has that been evolving on the group level and on the subsidiary level? How does the ROE of the subsidiaries compare versus the group itself? And where are you seeing areas that need to be improved upon? And also how you compare that to peers across the region? So maybe you can give us a bit of flavor on that.
So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but starting off at the group level, we reported an ROE of 15%. And if we then break it into the various countries. Kenya came in at 17%, which is a very strong performance in this difficult market. In Tanzania space, where we are still continuing to invest platforms, we are also looking at increased capitalization of the business. And particularly in 2020, when we'd experienced losses, we reported a return on equity of
of 4.8%. If we move to Rwanda, very strong performance as well, ROE of 14%. And that reflects the greater maturity of that business, as this is one of the oldest businesses in our portfolio. It's actually older than Kenya's at 60 years of age. Mature business continued to generate capital organically. And we expect that we're going to see rising returns from all the investments that are happening in that space. Uganda, our most recent acquisition, joined the portfolio back in 21. ROE reported was 6.8%. And that also reflects the rather high levels of capital that we have to keep from a regulatory perspective in the Uganda market. As in the Eastern Africa space, they have some of the highest required levels of capital. You have to keep about $40 million now if you want to open and operate a bank in Uganda, and we are compliant. And then in Mauritius, the return of equity is the highest across the portfolio, 20%. So that's the overview on the ROE side. We are obviously looking to get all of this up. Capital optimization is a big focus for the group, but we expect that the ROE numbers will improve for all the businesses.
What can we learn from what you've done in Mauritius, where the ROE is specifically above the group average? So what are you learning there that you can implement across the other subsidiaries?
Of course, the drivers of ROE will vary from time to time, depending on key circumstances. So if you have good performance in terms of releases, for example, your distressed loan book, that's going to bump up your profit after tax, ultimately. If you're able to contain costs, that's also going to drive your PAT and ultimately your ROE. So the focus really is on how do we grow the top line? So you will see that we reported strong operating income growth right across all our businesses. So that's important. We need to see our growth in core operating income. That's important. We are also looking at the cost to income ratios across our different businesses. And we know that the subsidiaries have present very high cost to income ratios. And that reflects the level of investment that needs to be put in to the various subsidiaries to derive the kind of income that we are expecting. So cost focus is important. Of course, capital optimization varies from business to business. We have at present, 3 out of the 5 subsidiaries, I would say, that we have, which do not really need to see injections of capital, as it were, given the phase that they are in, their more steady state, if you like, and to growing. But in a couple of our markets, we are continuing to inject capital as needed to support the ambitions that we have for growth. And we will expect that will happen in the next strategy cycle through 2026. So both a combination of organic capital generation, as well as when needed, an infusion of capital. We're taking lessons from around the portfolio and applying them. We are looking at how we can really leverage from group synergies to make sure that we do not replicate costs across the group, and that will really help with optimizing the returns that we get.
Thank you so much on that. Ronak, maybe this at this point, I can allow you to ask one or two questions and then I come back again.
Thanks. Yeah, maybe we can just continue this discussion of capital allocation across the subsidiaries. Kiara, like you mentioned, a lot of the investments have been done, but the ROEs have been low and have been low for a number of the subsidiaries for a while. And from what you're saying, the solution seems to be to allocate even more capital. I guess the idea is to maybe try and gain scale, because as we know, banking is a scale business. But given the markets that you operate in are relatively very competitive, you know, if you look at Uganda, very dominant bank, at the same time, Equity Bank is growing quite aggressively, Tanzania dominated by 2 banks. Wouldn't it make more sense from a minority's perspective, maybe just not allocate any more capital, if anything, maybe just wind down those investments and return that capital to shareholders, given the low ROEs it's generating?
I think we have to look at where we are in the cycle. We've just bought a business in Uganda. The strategic thinking behind that is we actually are the conduit for a lot of business into Uganda as Kenya. One of our largest export trading partners is, of course, Uganda. We see it directly in our portfolio. We've supported clients previously before our entry into Uganda. We've been supporting them from here. It makes sense to reduce the kind of country risk that you carry by holding presence in Uganda. It's a growing economy. We know that there will be opportunities for getting scale. We talked about the high capitalization levels that are required. You put in capital, you must sweat. And our business has actually been, even with the 3 years, we've reported now 2 out of 3 years of profitability, and we expect that to continue. If opportunities for scaling inorganically come in, we would also look at that as well. And I'm sure that with the higher levels of capital that are being asked for by the regulator, they will certainly show up. It is important that we appreciate that our strategy focuses on being present in the Eastern Africa region. We know that Kenya acts as a hub for a lot of businesses, and we know that if we are able to entrench ourselves with our customers who operate within the region, that will play out in even stronger returns across the market. In Tanzania, of course, another very well-endowed country, you're right, that is a market that requires significant skill. But if you're operating smartly in that market as well, you can certainly get the kind of returns that you're looking for in that market. However, it does require you to invest in the initial stages. You need to get the right platforms. You need to get enough capital to write the kind of business that you need to write. And we are also working on the regulatory side. How do we lobby regulators to enable the group to be able to leverage synergies from other parts of the business into that market that you're not utilizing as much capital as presently is structured? It isn't a decision we take lightly, and we will certainly continue to support different initiatives to grow our revenues in that market and to enhance returns.
Interesting. Just maybe not to dwell too much time on this, but yeah, as a minority, I'm thinking Kenyan T-bills rates are now anywhere between 16 to 18%. I would much just prefer being paid a dividend and then I invest in the Kenyan T-bills. But it seems from a group perspective, you believe the investments you are making will eventually pay up. You'll eventually be able to get a higher threshold than what the current T-bill rates are generating. Would you be able to put a timeline in terms of when you might be able to generate returns at least above your cost of equity?
That's an evolving story. Obviously, we are looking at the plan period to make progress on that front. But as I said, you have quite a lot of blanks, I think, of that strategy that you need to follow, including also making sure that the enabling environment is provided in that market. So I won't give a timeline to it. I know that we get surprises from time to time, but certainly the intention is to be able to cover our cost of equity as soon as possible.
Understood. Eric, if I may, maybe just one more question on the margins.
All right.
You had quite detailed explanation on the margins earlier on, and well done for actually improving your margins compared to most of your peers whose margins shrunk. One of the things I noticed was your lending rate, effective lending rate, by my calculations, was up to around 13.2% from around 11.4% in 2022. How much of that is attributable to the rate rises implemented by the central bank, and how much of it could be attributable to the implementation of the risk pricing model that was approved by the Central Bank of Kenya? And just maybe as a follow-up to that, I'm guessing this risk pricing model hasn't been fully implemented last year because of various reasons that we've heard from your peers. So once the risk pricing model gets fully approved, what kind of normalized lending rate can we expect from the bank?
That's an interesting question, Ronak, and I think it speaks to some of the policy measures that have been pushed by the regulators, but also that have been called for by the market. Now, right at the outset, I'd say that we don't quite have a strong transmission mechanism for monetary policy. I think the signaling that comes in from the central bank is important and does somewhat get transmitted, but you don't quite get direct linkages into that because there are a number of other factors that need to be at play for that to work as effectively as intended. And for this, for example, we need to be able to see people taking risk on fixed income and saying that these decisions are influencing the positions that they take. Secondly, I think that while we do have a yield curve that goes out commendably, even out to 25, even 30 years, I think that we don't have enough trading happening at various points of the curve. And that is perhaps again back to the reason that we don't have enough liquidity that comes in the trading space for people to really reflect some of these interest rate moves. So you find that what is really driving pricing in the balance sheets is what you could refer to as your spot prices in your markets. So if interest rates are rising because there is a signal that's coming in from government debt prices, then of course your customers are going to ask for higher deposit rates comparable to the treasury bill rates that they see. And as those costs rise, then you reflect the higher costs of your funding in your loan book. ALM becomes a very important driver of margin management, and you have to really make sure that you're able to flexibly pivot whenever big interest rate moves happen like we saw them in the last year, while at the same time being cognizant that obviously your customers are also struggling to adjust. So you need to do this appreciating that there'll be customers who will struggle along the way, but there's also an important signal that's being sent. So an interesting discussion. Perhaps we don't have enough time for it here.
Sure. And risk pricing model, has it been fully implemented?
So the risk-based pricing model, I think nobody in the market has actually truly implemented it, at least not perhaps even those who have signed it off. I think we have said we have been having continuing discussions with the central bank in our case. However, once it comes in, I expect that what will quickly follow is other aspects that need to strengthen the policy transmission framework, as we've had some challenges with data in the market, that if we want to truly reflect what CBR, for example, is signaling to us about the margins we should be charging on clients, we've had some disruption the past 5 years or so. We continue to look at our data and what it is telling us, and also then, of course, complete the decisions that we are making with other data that comes from CBR without entirely relying on it. Some of the risk-based pricing models have been relying on what signals you get from your CBR. But as I said, even once it comes in, there will still be some way to go before you can truly reflect the risk-based pricing in the way we actually operate in the market.
Thank you. I have a question for Ronak. Maybe to softball questions. There's quite a number of listeners joining us today who maybe have no clue what I&M Bank does. Maybe you can tell them a bit of your bank strategy, positioning, and some of the product you offer and where people can find you in the meantime.
Yes, indeed. So we have been on a strategy journey that started back in 2016. We have branded our strategy Imara. We have just in 2024 started our third cycle. We are calling Imara 3.0. The first two parts of our journey really were about putting in place, number one, in Imara 1.0, the foundation that we needed to be able to really compete effectively, putting in the technology that we needed, starting to think more cohesively as a group, looking at how to equip our people with the skills that they needed to be able to deliver an ambitious strategy. And that worked well. We were able to really get our platforms in order, start making investments in the digital platforms that we were going to build. And in Imara 2.0, which started back in 2021, we then set out to build out the customer value propositions that really underpinned the diversification we're looking at. We started looking at new markets in the personal space, in the business banking space. We enhanced our digitization as well. We diversified sectors in our corporate institutional banking space. And that has led to a greater contribution coming from what were not our traditional focus areas. So this is the personal and business banking space, which now contributes roughly 50% of income. And then in this new cycle, we are looking at scaling. I talked about the investments that we've made in technology, and we are now focusing on sweating those assets. We are looking at the businesses that we've built and looking at getting scale in them. We are also focusing on sustainability, which has been an important focus for us. Over the last 2 years, we've been looking at how we can better do this. As you all know, ESG has become an important consideration for everybody who is doing business. And we are looking beyond profits to say, how can we be impact the communities in which we operate? So we are looking at, over the planned period, impacting over 10 million people. And that is cut across different ways. It is including everything from how people access finance, how they get banking services, to some of the big questions of the day around how we can be less wasteful, how we can conserve the environment. And we, an important plank for us in doing so is the I&M Foundation and the work that we do there. We set aside 2% of our profits before tax every year to fund the activities of the foundation. We spent over 800 million shillings in the last cycle just supporting the different initiatives we have in that space. We are expecting that we are going to see really an acceleration in growth. We are talking about getting to more than 1 million customers. And expect that we are going to see, as we scale up the income side, we're also going to see our cost to income ratio come down, as I say, to less than 45%. So quick snapshot, we could talk all day about our strategy. A lot of thought has gone into it. And we are very particular about how do we deliver it through our people. We've looked at our cultural transformation side. We have our cultural transformation strategy we call Pamoja. So let me stop there because you could get me going on this one.
On asset allocation and maybe capital allocation, one question here is about what's the group's stated objective on dividend payout? And then the DPR is quite low when you compare it to peers at 3%. And then you have peers like Absa and Tanbic doing 50% and even Stanchart doing almost 80%. I think one key question that comes to mind when we keep discussing with them is why not increase their dividend payout ratio in a place where the book value, or at least the share price, is trading around 40% of book value? Long-winded question, but in short, what's the DPR? Why is the DPR very low compared to peers?
This question was asked earlier in the presentation and the comparators that we were being given. I meant to find out what the holding companies of those cited banks actually have as their dividend payout ratio. You may have it, but it's certainly something that I want to find out. Nevertheless, there's no competition on DPR. Every business is unique. Everybody has something that they're doing, and we are no different. We focus on how we're going to finance our businesses to be able to be compliant and to be able to achieve the ambitions that they have for growth. And we then make our decision based on that. I know we've been pushed in the past. Can you state what your target DPR is and so on? We had a 33% payout ratio. I think last year it was 32%, which is healthy in a market like this. But remember that we have been generating capital organically. We don't want to say to our shareholders, oh, we have this need to grow in a particular market, can we do a rights issue when you've already utilized that money? So we are careful about those decisions. They're informed by what we need to do, and you can be sure that they're done. In terms of asset allocation, of course, we are looking at what the different portfolios that we run require, and we are then making those choices based on the opportunities we have, the returns that we are getting in those markets, and the need to be relevant in those different segments as well.
One specific question for the acting CFO. The SLRR are up there at 11.25% from my calculations here. Most peers are very low of it. Many are at 0%. Why is SLRR around 11.3%, so to speak?
Okay, so thank you for the question. So I will not address the SLR as a percentage. The question is, what are the inputs arriving at this statutory position, right? So IFRS, this is now the accounting rules or dictates, to have some processes to arrive at provisions as per the accounting standards. At the same time, locally, we also need to adhere to CBK prudential guidelines. So those two are very different approaches in making provisions against all our exposures, right? So the difference between those two approaches is what now they're taking as part of SLRR. So now, right from this, you ask, what's the difference between our group and maybe the names that you're comparing us to? Most of our loans that we underwrite actually are secure. And that is now where the CBK or the local regulations will not factor in the potential value out of these securities. So the approaches being different, so we will have that divergence. And that is what we park as statutory provisions. So it rose, yes, year on year. It's purely reflective of the fact that majority of the loans are underwrite properly secured.
Ronak, back to your question.
Maybe just as a follow-up on that, SLR. I guess coming back to Eric's question, one of the things we notice is there's a big difference between INM and the other banks. We're not seeing the other banks report such significant SLRs, maybe with the exception of one other bank. Why is there such a noticeable difference between the way INM provisioning, the provisioning between CBK and IFRS? Why is it so different at INM compared to most of your peers?
So it will also speak to our confidence in the various securities we are holding. And if I go back 2, 3, 4 years, for as long as I've been here, we've been seeing successes in various recovery rates. And that is now what would point or give us confidence that the various assets we are holding or collaterals against these loans are recoverable. And as such, now we'll be happy to have them as part of our receivables as per IFRS guidelines.
Okay. And just a very quick summary, what are the assets that makes up most of the collateral? Is it real estate?
So it will be varied, and most certainly it will not cover things like debentures, which they would change year on year. So a number of the real estate fixed assets, or rather immovables, would also be in there.
Yes. And I think you do have to recall, of course, that even as you take on debentures, there are assets in those debentures that we also value conservatively, because we do know that at the time of realization, if you have to, that the rates that you get are actually relatively low. So we always take a conservative view. Hopefully, this SLR question will be put to bed, because we get it every year. We explain it every year. It still comes up.
Hopefully, this detail will help clarify the issue. Eric?
A key question. There was a bit of an acquisition into the bank by the East African Growth Holding, around 10% thereabouts. Any comment on what that was all about?
We've had the British International Investment as a shareholder since 2016, and they wanted to sell their stake to a like-minded investor and approached East African Growth Holding, and the actual purchaser is Africinvest, and this is their vehicle. You will have seen what's in the public space in the announcement that we made. And we have actually got Africinvest as a shareholder partner in our Rwanda business. So we know them well, and we are aligned on the strategic direction that we want to take. All that remains now is to get the necessary approvals from regulators.
In a perfect world, though, what would make the share price of I&M Bank get to at least to be equal to book value? From your perspective, what would be a good catalyst? Are some of these buy-ins from these kind of groups a good way to maybe unlock shareholder value for the share price?
that could be one trigger, but I think you still need the real big driver, which is that the market's price discovery mechanisms work as they should. I would hazard that the stock or the securities exchange is not quite delivering on that particular aspect of its mandate. And you need, therefore, to really work on what's underpinning that undervaluation that you see across so many counters in the securities exchange. If you fix that, then you get all information filtering out. I think we showed you our NAV share. I think it's at 53 shillings and 30 cents at the moment. And that's a good proxy for what kind of intrinsic value the group has. And as you said, in a perfect world, all of that information would be known. And you should see a more reflective share price.
A few questions on subsidiaries before we maybe go back to Ronak and then we conclude soon because we need to finish at the top of the hour. So one is on Tanzania. It seems like it's been suboptimal for a couple of years. What could be a good way to unlock value there? And then also Rwanda, Equity and KCB have come in quite strong. You have a copying strategy to be able to beat them there also. And then finally, there was a bit of a mention on Ghana and what happened to Bank One and its investment in Ghana. So speak to those three questions.
Okay, I think we tackled Tanzania. I think it's a market where scale really matters, but you also need to be smart about the business that you write. So the focus there is on being positioned right, getting the right customer value propositions in place, getting the right kind of capital in place to do the kind of transactions you want to do. Focusing on non-funded income, being good at that as well. As I said, it's a continuing story and we've got the right leadership in place to be able to drive that. In Rwanda, yes, we have seen some major acquisitions happen in that market. We have seen as a result, perhaps from the latest one, an improvement in the, shall we say, relative strength of being a position for one of those banks. But we presently four and we have great pedigree. We are the oldest bank in Rwanda. We have great people. Most of the people who are in senior positions in these other banks ahead of us have come from IDEM. What we have to work on is how we make sure that we can grow organically and improve our performance over time, given perhaps the quality of the targets in that market. But we are very resilient. We are ambitious in that market and we expect that we are going to see significant progress in our positioning in the coming cycle. In the Ghana question, I think we all know that there was a big shock in the Ghanaian market. Obviously, Bank One's strategy is very sub-Saharan Africa focused, particularly on financial institutions and sovereigns, and had invested on the back of a syndicating portfolio there. And of course, when the downturn came, there was a write-down that needed to happen. Fortunately, the portfolio is actually insured and has been paying out. So the shock to that particular investment isn't as deep as perhaps others have had. And we are in talks, of course, to recover even the balance from the reorganization that's proposed by the government in Ghana. So we do expect to see most, if not all, of our money come back in that market.
Thank you on that. Ronak, any final question before we conclude now?
You know, to end on a slightly more interesting note, you mentioned quite a bit in terms of the technology investments they've made and the initial execution of that seems quite promising. When we look at the customer digital transaction numbers, it seems to have grown quite substantially on a quarter-on-quarter basis, not on a year-on-year basis. Maybe could you just talk what type of transactions these were and how should we be thinking in terms of how is the bank monetizing these transactions, if at all? So that's one. And then the second part, and again, I'd like to understand if there's any potential upside in this quarter from the appreciation of the G2G transactions that the bank is involved in and the appreciation of the shilling. Because my understanding is the oil marketers were distributing while depositing money in shillings, and then the bank was supposed to source the dollars. So given that they were depositing shillings at a much higher rate, could that potentially translate into very significant FX gain in this quarter?
Let me start with the digitization question and say that a lot of the infrastructure that we have put in, digital infrastructure that we put in, has actually been home built. So we have a digital factory here that's been developing the I&M on the go platform. Of course, the other satellite systems, your card management system, being integrated into the platform. We are looking at integrating our wealth management offering into I&M OTG and various other feature enrichment initiatives that are underway. So we are very proud of what we've built at I&M OTG. And this is what means then the transactions that are being done. Now, we also had a key initiative last year. We were the only bank to do as everyone was returning back to charging customers on the transfers to wallets and vice versa. We took the bold decision not to do that because we could hear the feedback that we're getting from our clients. And that has led to a very pleasant outcome in terms of growth. I think our customer growth numbers in 2023 reached about 24% or so. And that is on the back of a greater acceptance of the steps that we took to facilitate relatively costless transfers between those two particular systems. So basically your wallets and your banks. Now, we also have, of course, connections into various payment gateways, but also with various payment partners that we integrated with. If you've ever used your I&M OTG to pay your electricity bill, we were the very first ones to actually give you real-time results on what your electricity bill is. Immediately you pay it, you can actually check again and you'll see that it is paid and not have to trust that you'll get a statement that tells you about a month later, right? And as a result, we saw KPLC, for example, insisting on other banks doing the same thing. We are looking at bridging these platforms to drive volumes of traffic and value of traffic. I think we did 1.2 trillion shillings in value from various transactions that go over the digital platforms. And that can only grow, really. We are focused on a couple of things that drive that. Number one is making sure that people feel safe using those platforms. There's greater adoption. We have high adoption in Kenya. People need to feel safe. So we invest very heavily in our cyber security as well. But the second thing is, of course, that you have high uptime. And this is something we check on a minute-by-minute basis to just see, can we ensure that our platforms are up? And we're investing, of course, in future-proofing our platforms so that they can carry the kind of traffic that we anticipate. That's the digital question. And it really spans across the board from whether it is trade transactions that we're supporting to just simply money for investments and all. And now you can open accounts digitally, you can invest in money market instruments digitally. And as I said, we're extending it into the wealth space as well. So soon you should be able to do those transactions in the wealth space on that platform. So that's the digital question. I think on the G2G query, the structure for G2G really looks at target rates for what the rates for acquiring the dollars of the over the plan period, over the 6-month period that you have for the trade transaction would be. So it's a pleasant surprise, of course, that the shilling has strengthened. It makes it easier to hit those target rates, even though, of course, they're moving targets. If you open an LC today, the target rate is obviously going to be a lot lower. But the most important thing is that you now have liquidity having returned into the market, spreads have thinned, and it means that it's much easier for people to source the FX that they need and can more confidently plan when it comes to fulfilling the needs that they have for buying the Forex to fund the LC. Will it lead to greater FX income? Actually, not really. I expect that what it will do certainly is give us greater confidence about pricing and ultimately lead to perhaps contributing to an inflation tick down simply because you're getting lower prices and lower spreads, really, because of the more efficient markets.
We should be now winding up. So maybe from your perspective now, what are your priorities for 2024 so that we come back in around a year's time and we do the spaces and reflect on 2024? So maybe you can give us a bit of perspective on FY24 priority and what your outlook is for the year. And finally, what's the bank strategy, which you call Imara 3.0 now going to be like going forward?
As you start off on your strategy cycle, your base year is always really important to get right. We talked about the focus we have on building ecosystems, on really the need to entrench ourselves in sectors where we are new, and of course, making sure that we are also consolidating it where our real strength areas of corporate and premium banking. So the focus really then is to make sure we are managing margins, protecting the gains that we've made in those spaces. So asset and liability management is really critical in that regard. We're not out of the woods yet when it comes to the challenges that we have on the macros. And it's important that we then manage that effectively. We are keen to grow our customer numbers. We are continuing to consolidate the gains we've made in the digital platforms and roll out more and more features and drive the engagement that we get on these platforms. So globally speaking, that is it. We have across the group, of course, different initiatives at different times. Some we are still investing platforms and others we are also strengthening the people space. We are looking really to leverage our ecosystems and the different partnerships that we have. We're looking at diversifying in our business segments. We talked earlier about the focus on the public sector, the MSME space, and the oil and gas, which we just discussed a few minutes ago, looking at widening our expertise and reach in the region. All very ambitious areas, all very exciting areas, and we expect that we will have a robust discussion about how we've performed a year on from now.
Right. So now closing thoughts. We start with the CFO and then the CEO, and then we close there.
So number one, thank you for having us and especially me. I think to the audience there, I&M is a good bank with. The numbers are very strong from where I sit, liquidity-wise, very strong in terms of capital adequacy and adherence to various CBK ratios as they required. We are very strong. So I&M is quite a resilient place to be, and I think we are going places. So towards this space, we should be headed towards position 5, probably in 2 to 3 years.
So from my end, you had the CFO has set out what his expectations are. Our focus really is on making sure that our aspiration, which is to be Eastern Africa's leading financial partner for growth, are achieved. And we have a robust strategy, and we do welcome the kind of interventions, engagements that we have with stakeholders like yourselves, to make sure that we are understood and that our brand continues to grow. We turned 50 this year as I&M Bank, and we're proud of the legacy that has been built over the years. We are just custodians of that legacy, and we need to ensure that generations that come are able to really appreciate that there was growth during this period and the brand just went from strength to strength. So thank you again for giving us an audience like this, and we look forward to continuing to interact.
Excellent. Glad to have you here, and thank you, Ronak, also for joining us as usual to ask questions alongside us. Maybe Ronak, you can say your closing thoughts.
No, thank you very much once again for having me, and thanks, Kiara and Billy, for the very engaging discussion. Thank you so much.
Do check out I&M. I think Peso there and them Bank, also Uganda account, was on the spaces today. So thank you so much for joining us, for the team from I&M. Definitely want to host you once again to discuss some of the products that you've elaborated upon during the spaces today. So we'll get in touch with your team once again to have you here. So see you again soon. And thank you so much for joining us once again.